Morning, everybody, or lunchtime, whatever this is. This morning I'd like to talk about something that I'm very passionate about, too. This last speaker was really stimulating. And so what I want to do today, well, first, Drew Lyon is one of the authors here. He's over here, and Dr. Dwayne Westfall is not here today, but he's going to show up tomorrow sometime. So my objective this morning is to demonstrate the impact of long-term field experiments. And so that's a little bit of a summary of what I talked about last year to this group. So that'll be a little repeat. And then I want to talk about another thing I'm even more passionate about, I think. I don't really like that passionate word. Just interested, okay? Really interested in the kind of stuff that we do for landscape and climate. So the bottom line is that it's my belief that we need long-term work to be able to solve future soil management problems. And if we don't have the long-term work today, we won't have the ability to solve those problems when they pop up. Okay, so a little history. Soil science has its roots in the field. And when it started, you can see a little photo of Rothamsted there. We have observation, field treatments, and then there was this chemistry laboratory connection with the field. And that's what Gilbert and Laws were trying to do at Rothamsted. If you haven't been there, you owe yourself a trip. What was the motivation for their work? They wanted to improve soil management. And I don't think you'd be in this room this morning if you aren't interested in problems with soil management. So, soil science, basic roots, soil management. So how'd they do it? Well, we just heard, I've got an example of the old rotation, some plots there. And it was a large experimental unit, no reps, and no measure of experimental error. So then along comes this guy, R.A. Fisher. I understand he's a real character. I had a professor at Iowa State that had worked under him, and he was also a character. The concept of randomization and replication came in, and then experimental design. We've all been in those kind of classes. And so as a result, something happened. And some people don't like to hear me talk about this, but I don't really care what you think. You're here now, you can leave. Reductionism became a possibility. Now, what is reductionism? Well, my definition is it's an approach to understand the nature of complex things by reducing them to the interactions of their parts or to simpler or more fundamental things. And we're all for that. I mean, that's obviously important. It's a valuable tool. We need it, we still use it, we will continue to use it, but it can cause a loss of the big picture perspective. And so that's where I'll head before we finish this talk. So how has it affected field research? We have more narrowly focused experiments. We have much less linkage between experiments. You do one in Kansas, I do one in Colorado, I do one in Wisconsin, and you know, it's just lucky if any of them relate to each other. So there's less emphasis on the system, and we have what's known as scaling down. So ultimately, that results in less consideration of the big picture. Okay, so now I want to talk about a reductionist experiment and show you the value. And this is the one I talked about last year, so we'll go kind of quickly. Charlie Fenster is one of the icons in soil management research, especially in dryland areas. Charlie just had his 95th birthday this summer, and he's very healthy, I'm glad to report. And Charlie and Drew Lyon and I published a paper that's in the Soil Science Society, and we did it based on this experiment. So I'm not going to tell you a lot about the experiment this morning. If you want to get into that, we can do that later in the questions. But this experiment has the treatments that you see there, and it's definitely a reductionist kind of experiment. I mean, it's not repeated anywhere else. It is replicated, but it's not in various climates. It's only on one soil type, and so it's definitely what we would call reductionism. One soil, one climate, three reps. Pretty typical of a lot of things we do. Okay, so has it been effective? And this was the theme of my talk last year. It's still my theme today. It is effective. And out of that long-term experiment, this is what's happened. Look at all those things that have accumulated. The question is if anybody reads them or not. All right? Yeah. You know, we're all good at this. But I'm happy to report that they are being read. And one of the gauges that we have today, we can use Web of Science, or we can use Google Scholar, and we can not only find out if people are reading them, but we can find out if they're citing them. Now, they may read them and not cite them. You know, I think that's highly possible. So that those two organizations cite papers by author per year. So this is a little table that takes the journal publications. There are 50 of them. There may be more now. I didn't update this slide from a year ago. And you can see the different things that have been written about from this experiment. And you can see the citations. Now, I wish I had a paper that had lots of citations. I unfortunately don't have any of these big ones, but 4,900 total citations. That's a big number. Okay. So I want to just illustrate the impact of this reductionist experiment using this technique. These are things I said last year, if you happen to be here. There are several classic papers. There's one by Ted Elliott that has 700 citations, and there's one by Johann Sex and co-authors that has 476. And I'll just show you the citation data in this form. Along the x-axis, you have years, and on the y-axis, you have the cumulative citations. Now, what I want you to see there is that that line did not, you know, when we hit about 2010, it didn't break over and everybody quit reading and citing the paper. It just keeps going up. Here's the one by Johann Sex and his colleagues. Same thing. Now, this is a much newer, younger paper, I guess we should say. And look at that baby go. So is that experiment having an impact? I think so. And you can read some of these papers if you like, but very important. Okay, so now, back to my reductionist business. It's a really good way to gain a better understanding of processes. And those two papers that I just showed you as illustrations, they are process-oriented papers, definitely. The problem is, it's reduced the emphasis on the system. This is my assessment. So what do we need for the 21st century? Now, some of you have heard me give this kind of talk before, too. This is something that Dwayne Westfall and I worked on for a few years, and Megan's here today, and she's continuing to work on this. And so what do we need? It's my opinion that we need a better understanding of climate-landscape interactions with cropping systems. Now, before I go any further, when I came to CSU, I started teaching class, and it was a soil management class, and I showed somebody some data from Akron, Colorado. I remember this very plainly. I don't remember the name of the student, but he came up after class, and he says, Pete, Doc Pete, he was very respectful, will that work where I live? And I said, where do you live? He said, I live near Lyman, Colorado. Well, Lyman is a little bit different than Akron. It's higher elevation. It's a little drier. You know, it's just a little different. So I said, you know, I really don't know. I guess you're going to have to try it and see. Well, that really isn't all that satisfactory. So I got to thinking about that. And I also had been driving through eastern Colorado, and I began to think about the fact that all of the experiments, and by the way, there are really a lot of good experiments at the Akron station, and there are some experiments at different locations in Colorado, but you know what? They're all on the very best possible land you can find on the experiment station, right? Not eroded very much, fertilized sometimes too much. I mean, they're ideal places. So I got to thinking, when I drive by these fields where you've got these soil catenas, what would happen if we had experiments that covered those kind of things? So we decided to try this climate landscape approach. And our research question was about the sustainability of wheat fallow. Now, I realize some of you don't care about wheat fallow. You have no reason to care about wheat fallow, but I just want to point out that it's a really bad deal, although it has kept a lot of farmers in business. So, you know, it has its upsides. Well, these are all the things that are wrong with wheat fallow. The one that caught our eye was the less than 25% of the precip stored in the fallow period. So what I want you to understand is that these systems are winter wheat fallow systems in Colorado are fallow 14 months out of every 24. And during that period of time, you only store 25%, if you're lucky, of the water that falls out of the sky. I can turn that around. That means that 75% has gone somewhere, mostly the evaporation. So what we did was design an experiment that has climate, landscape, and cropping systems all in the same bucket. So in the upper right hand there, we have the climate variable. What we chose were three sites. By the way, I wanted 10 sites, and Dwayne said, "You're nuts," and he was correct. It's one of the few times that he's been right. So we chose three sites that had roughly the same precip level, between 400 and 425 millimeters of precip annually, including the snow water. But they differed in PET. And we just judged the PET using the open pan evaporator, and you can see that it goes from roughly 1,600 up in the northeast to a very big, almost 2,000 down there in the southeast. So that means that a unit of water doesn't go anywhere near as far for production in that southeastern location. Then we went out and we stayed away from experiment stations, mainly because we didn't have any in these locations that would work. And we chose farmer fields that had a soil gradient. Now, are the soils the same in northeastern Colorado as they are in the southeast? Absolutely not. You know, it's drier in the southeast. You cannot find the same soils. So the soils are not the same across the three sites. But there is a soil sequence at each site. And so that soil sequence is represented by what you see in the lower left-hand corner. And we didn't have a combine that would do continuous yields like we had now. We started this in 1985. And so we went out and made a lot of holes in the ground and figured out where we could have a consistent soil across what we call a summit position, and then a consistent side slope, which is the eroded part of the sequence, and then the toe slope position that's the catch of all the extra water that runs off from the side slope. And so then we would harvest from those areas, and that was our yield. We'd soil sample, we'd take residue samples, just everything you can think of were measured by those soil positions. And then across the soils, we had those cropping systems that you see there, the wheat fallow, the wheat corn fallow, wheat, corn, millet, fallow, opportunity, which is actually a continuous cropping, and then we planted a perennial grass. And the purpose of the perennial grass was to find out how our treatments would compare, how the effect of our treatments on our soil organic carbon would occur relative to the best possible carbon situation, which is the native mixture of grasses. Now, this is also the time that CRP was coming in. We had a lot of farmer interest in the CRP, and so this really fit. You know, they were curious about it. Okay, so there's another one in here. I just slip it right in there on you. The time variable. This is the big deal. You know, you've got all these climate variables now. You've got soil variables, and you want to know what's happening with water budgets, what's happening with carbon. So it's really important that these don't happen for just 2 or 3 years and then we turn them back to the farm. This is the long-term part of it. So they've been going since 1985 and we've had some struggles, and I'll tell you a little bit about those as we go along. So now, when we proposed this, we had a lot of static from some people. I'm not going to name them because you might know them. We had static. And so it was like this. Well, the static came, we said, "Would you like to cooperate with us?" Because we needed a, fill in the blank, weed scientist, entomologist. You know, there's a lot of stuff that's going to happen here. So right away, I can remember this man. I can see his face right now, and I'm not going to tell you his name. He said, "I can't participate with you because," by the way, "we have two replications of these treatments." He says, "With two reps?" Oh, no, he says, "You have to have six reps or you can't do this. You will not be able to detect any treatment differences." And of course, if you can't detect any treatment differences, you can't publish. Right? Okay. See, what's good about this is all these things were wrong. Right? You're introducing too much variability. Now we're back to reductionism. You know why we do reductionist stuff? We go out and we pick areas where the soils are uniform, because after all, if you want the experimental air to really represent the right things, which is the interaction of the treatment of the rep and the, so forth, the test, you don't want variability. Well, Duane and I were introducing a lot of variability. Would you agree? Climate, soils, it was just, you know, too much for some people to handle. And then the big one. Well, you obviously have to do this for a long time, or it's not going to be any worth of anything. And there's no funding available for that kind of research. I had a young assistant professor that told me this. He said, I just don't want any part of this because we can't fund it. He didn't get tenure. Okay. So it's too difficult to manage this, because I want you to understand, the closest one of these is 120 miles from the campus. The second one is 200 miles from campus, and the third one is 350 miles from campus. So you can't do it. And not only that, you don't have any of the equipment, because after all, you've got to get there, you've got to get back, you've got to combine, you've got to do all that stuff. You all know this. And you don't have enough people. Okay. So what really happened? Well, the two reps weren't an issue. The treatment differences are statistically detectable. Now, I want to give you another pet peeve. You know, when I was in graduate school, we didn't have any choices. When you got out the old textbook, you know, your statistics textbook, it had two testing levels. It was the 1% alpha level and the 5, right? You might find one that had a 10% table, but you didn't use that. So over time, a lot of people have not understood what you're trying to protect against with type 1 error. And a lot of agronomic experiments should never be tested at the 1 and 5% levels. 25 and 30 are probably adequate. We can argue about that too. So then the other criticism was, we can't publish this stuff. Well, there are now 50 publications in referee journals, and there are more than 75 other things that come from all sorts of places. I underlined this one because I have a lot of friends in ARS that are really interested in modeling. Some of them are even in this room. And lo and behold, they like these data sets that come out, because it's a good way to find out if the model has some need for tweaking. And then, you know, all that stuff about it's not reductionist enough. Well, it turns out that's not true either. Because right within these long-term experiments, people have come in and done what I call sub-experiments. So they've actually looked at some process level kinds of things right inside of these big ones. So there have been some studies on greenhouse gases, soil organic carbon, residue levels. And so we've actually had reductionist gains right from within. I feel like I'm preaching a sermon. So more important to me maybe than all of that, by the way, I really admire people in extension. And I've never had an extension appointment, but I've given a lot of extension talks. And I really like it, because you find out about reality. You know, they tell you, well, that's just a bunch of BS if they don't like what you're doing. And so you can discuss. And so these experiments have been the subject of field days, talks in the winter when it's too cold to go to the field. There's been a lot of activity. And so they've been very effective. And one of the things that's been so effective about them is that the plots are these strips that go across the soil catena. And so they come out there and they say, well, it's not a real farm, but it's closer than those other things. And so there's been realism that's come from some of these things, and people have actually adopted some of these things. So how did we fund it? Because that was one of the criticisms. It's never going to happen. Well, I had some friends in ARS, and they said, this is a good idea. One of them was Wayne Willis, and Wayne has passed on. But he said, we're going to do a cooperative agreement. And then there was Tom Army, and there was Vern Cole. And then there's Laja Hooja. And these scientists just continued to support this work through cooperative agreements. And then the Agricultural Experiment Station at CSU came alongside. They bought equipment. They did some other stuff, and then we got some other grants, and all of a sudden we had a thing going. Now, every year after that, it was like, what's the cooperative agreement going to do? Well, cooperative agreements up and down a little bit, and pretty soon other. It's not been easy, but it's been together now since 1985. Okay, so then what about the impact of this? Now, I don't really know how the impact is on farmers. It's hard to measure. There's been a big shift from wheat fallow farming in Colorado and western Kansas and western Nebraska to more rotation farming. So it's like one farmer said, well, we don't do it exactly like you, but we've learned something. And that something is you don't always have to wheat fallow. You can do other rotations. So what I can do today, though, is talk about the impact of some selected journal papers. And I'm going to use that citation index again, just like we did for that reductionist experiment to start with. So we had a paper that came out. This is this Dr. Moore came through, and Jerry Nielsen from Montana State brought him into the picture. And they said, could we come out and do a terrain analysis on the Sterling site? And we said, okay. And they came, and they wrote this paper and made one of us a co-author, and has 464 citations. And then Duane and I have a paper, came out, it's got some more concepts in it. And then we have a paper by Hamid Farahani that has some more. So what I want to show you, and then we have another one in 2004. So this is a sample of the publications that have come from this experiment. So again, what I like about this graph is the fact that it didn't plateau. People are still reading this paper. In fact, I'm really happy to be one of the co-authors, because this paper has more citations than any other one I've ever written. And it's all due to Dr. Moore and Jerry Nielsen. This is the one that we published about the concept, and it goes into some of the details about how we did it. And it's not anywhere near as dramatic as the other one, but the line's still going in the right direction. This is a paper that Hamid Farahani, who was a postdoc with ARS at the time, said to Duane and I, you know, I think we could, he's an engineer too, and so he's really good with computer stuff, data synthesis. And so he put together a paper that's in Advances in Agronomy. And this one, I'm so happy to be associated with this paper, because I think after I'm way gone, this paper will still be useful. And there aren't too many papers I've written that will still be useful, even maybe tomorrow. So it's still climbing. And then Duane and I published one in 2004. It's kind of a benchmark paper in terms of where things were after about the first 15 years of the experiment. And you can see that it's coming along. Okay, so now, how am I doing on time? Okay, I'll hurry. So I believe the long-term experiments are the best way to observe interactive effects of tillage and cropping systems on soil properties. It's the best way to quantify climate, soil, and cropping system interactive effects. But there's always this temptation, because it's not easy to get funding for these. So there's this temptation, and there's this thing, well, we've learned all we can learn, so now we ought to just cut it off. So I say resist the temptation. All right. Now, what limits us? That's what limits us. And the problem is this. You're all good at getting grants, I assume, or you wouldn't be here, right? We get grant money, if we're lucky, in three-year blocks, right? How are you going to run this experiment with three-year blocks of money? You're not. So you maybe get lucky and get a five-year one. And even that is not good enough. You need more. You need a commitment like ARS and the Agricultural Experiment Station in Colorado made to this, or you can't make it fly. So what are some potential funding mechanisms? The truth is, I don't know if any of this will work. But what I think that USDA, NIFA, really needs is to create a long-term, to create a funding category aimed at the long-term field research. Now, if you're familiar with NSF, they have the LTERs. If you know what that is, you can look it up on the internet. They're funded for a period of 25, 30 years if they keep their progress going, all right? That's one avenue. Now, our federal government right now, I don't know if this is even a remote possibility. And then, maybe closer to home and one you can impact more. I'm glad Lee Summers is here. He used to be my boss. He's retired now, too, so we don't have bosses, right? So land-grant universities could support long-term experiments by redirecting part of their Hatch Act funds. Those are more solid. Those come on a formula basis to each experiment station, and so they could be used for this if you're able to convince your director to go that route. Okay, so I'm done. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. We've got time for one question over here.
Here, I've got a question on how you archive the data and who has control of it. How do you phase it out to modelers and or extension? How do you manage that component of the data set?
Okay, so the question is how we archive data, how we manage it, and how people get access to it?
Correct.
We have had a cooperative agreement with ARS, and so there's a technician in the USDA ARS group in Fort Collins that's managing the data. And then the CSU scientists work with her, and we just decide if somebody asks whether or not we're going to give them access. So what we actually ask for when some modeler wants to use the data, that they said that they use one of the principal investigators on the paper as a co-author. So that's kind of the payment. Now, if you came and you just wanted to go out there and poke a few holes in the ground and do stuff, we'd have to work out some arrangement about how you would work in it. We also have archived soil samples from these experiments that go back to the beginning. So we actually don't have a very formal way to do this. But it's a good question.
Okay. Well, thank you. And for sake of time, we'll proceed on here. Thank you.